Well, ladies and gentlemen, very good afternoon and welcome to the afternoon technical session of Longwell USA, and welcome to our panel discussion, Longwell USA 2015 panel discussion. The topic we've chosen we think is very pertinent to the climate at this time. It seems that our industry is going through yet another strategic change. We're not quite sure what it is or where, what it's about, but it seems a little bit different to the many that we've experienced before. My name is Harry Martin, and I have the honour of being chosen to moderate this session this afternoon. We've chosen a panel based on experienced personnel from a number of companies that have played a major role in bringing Longwell to where it is today. I'll hasten to add there are many others, and we chose the panel pretty much at random, and we have a very good panel for you. I don't intend introducing each one by name. What I intend to do is give you a very small introduction and ask each one in turn, starting with Ed, to introduce himself and to make a statement relative to the topic we're going to discuss. And then, as quickly as possible, I'd like to throw it on to the audience, and we're very, very much looking forward to good participation from the audience. The objective of this panel, with our operators and suppliers, is to try to establish where we've come from, where we are, and what do we need to do from here on out. And hopefully, from the conclusions that you can draw in your mind, you can, whatever your role is in the mining industry, we hope the information will be useful to you for your planning, for your strategies going forward. The current basic longwall system in the US dates back to the 60s and 70s. Prior to that, longwalls were tried in the US a number of times, but each time they gained a bit of favour and they lost favour to the room and pillar system more widely used in the US. However, in the late 60s, early 70s, the type of longwall that was introduced to the USA based on European designs, European technology, European applications, stock, and it's that basic system that we have today. The basic difference being, or the main difference being, the demands for the system in US mines were very different to what they were in Europe for a number of reasons that we'd no need to go into. But the bottom line is, through the application of technology, as technology is developed, then the longwall standards in the USA became the standard of the world, if you like, the highest standards in the world. The standard that everywhere else in the world wanted to follow, as indeed Australia did, and some other parts of the world. Having said all that, with the exception of one or two, by far the highest productive longwalls, the safest longwalls, I'd hasten to say, do still belong to this day to the United States of America. And the technologies and demands by US operators to drive it to that position on the old European type longwall has been responsible for that. And anybody involved in US longwalling should take pride in that it is that, if you like, that foresight, that tenacity, that determination that has brought us to where we are. So the question is, with this change in environment, have we come far enough? Do we need to go further? Do we need to take a step back? And really, that's what this panel discussion is about today. If I can just throw a few figures out, and don't take my maths as being gospel or my calculations, but panel sizes, for example, over this period of time have increased in length as much as 2,000%, mainly in the USA. There are other parts of the world like China, Australia, South Africa, where they've emulated to a degree. But the USA, 2,000%. Panel widths, around 235%. If we look at some of the products, the armoured face conveyors, capacities increased by 700%. The chain widths, 85%. I should say the face conveyor widths, 85%. Chain sizes, 180%. Installed power, 650%. Shearers, up to 500%. Roof supports, hydraulic shields, supporting capacities, increased 600%. Extended heights, 120%, and widths, 90%. Hydraulic power packs, entry bolts, tail pieces and take-ups, beam stage loaders have all kept pace with the examples I've given to you. Remote control and automation, diagnostics, condition monitoring have also been applied wherever possible, and a major impact on bringing the longwalls, US longwall, to the state we are today. So I'd now like to hand over to the panel, and one by one, Ed, if you would like to give a brief, tell us who you are and make a statement pertinent to the panel discussion, maybe we can get this thing moving.
Sure, Harry.
Thank you.
Glad to do it. My name is Ed Niederreiter. I work for Joy Global, been with the company for 37 years. I spent the bulk of that time working on shear engineering. My current position is engineering director for longwall products at Joy, so I get to see the entire gamut of what we manufacture and hopefully have an impact on it. I guess echoing Harry's comments, I've been fortunate in my career in these 37 years to see this tremendous evolution that we've gone through from 130 horsepower cutter motors on shears to over 2,000 horsepower in cases. So, or 1,100 kilowatt, I'm sorry, about 1,500 horsepower. So that's quite an exciting thing. But I'd say going forward, I'd say the power in certain areas, the power demands will continue to grow to push the productivity. Heavier, long-lasting solutions on the mechanical side, but probably most importantly, I think, is the control and automation side. The things you can do with monitoring and automating the longwall to remove the people from areas of harm are probably the most exciting things, and probably where the future lies, I think, for the industry. Thanks.
Thanks, Ed. My name is Keith O'Neill. I've been in the industry for roughly 35 years. I started my career back in 1980 with the Bureau of Mines back then, when it was still part of the Department of Labor. Successively worked for longwall companies, starting with Hempscheid, DBT, Bucyrus, and now I'm the underground manager for product development and technology for underground products with Caterpillar. Like Ed, I've kind of grew up with the product and the evolution of the industry, particularly as longwall products are concerned. I echo Ed's remarks that power is now driving the industry. We've seen to come along quite nicely as far as coming up with solutions to increases in power necessary, such as on conveyors with CST drives, which is kind of actually a product staple right now. But the evolution of VFD drives will certainly change the picture of that landscape as well, as these faces grow wider and wider to accommodate and reduce costs of our operators on development. In terms of roof support design, we've seen from my early days 200 millimeter legs with a support capacity of 200 tons now grow to supports that can actually exceed 1,750 tons. So we're now able to generate the necessary power to control our roof quite well. However, there are still challenges that need to be met in that area, and it really has to do with automation. I also echo Ed's remarks about automation driving the safety mantra now that's come into our industry, as well as automation also creates efficiencies in that arena as well. So getting people off of the face to get them out of harm's way, also to create more efficiency and repetitiveness and consistency in our production output, is really going to drive our next evolution of mining product. Now, when we talk about automation, we can't forget about endurance. Getting people off the face still means getting them off the face. We can't have equipment that is not reliable enough to require routine or actually repetitive maintenance, because you're defeating the purpose. So technology can't take the place of engineering endurance. So with that, I'll pass the baton, and we can open the floor up discussion after these folks introduce themselves.
Yeah. Thank you very much. My name is Andreas Wahl. I'm managing director of the company Kamat in Germany, so I'm German, by the way, as well. We are building pumps and pump systems for underground coal mining longwall operations. In the US, here you probably know the name of our partner better. It's Swanson Industries from Morgantown, West Virginia. I am mining engineer by profession and myself as well in the general mining industry since roughly 30 years. From Kamat's point of view, what we see in terms of hydraulic stations for long walls, clearly as well a constant increase of power and an increase of power per unit, i.e. power per pump over the years. Today, a standard pump has roughly 250 kilowatt input power and produces 100 gallon per minute liquid. We have other pumps in operation, 350 kilowatt pumps, and there's a clear tendency to go for even bigger units. We have in China and in the United Kingdom, we have pumps in operation with an input power of 500 kilowatt per unit and producing 170 gallon per minute. So we see, and there will be a clear tendency as well with pump stations that the pumps become bigger and bigger. There is meanwhile an 800 kilowatt pump available from us. It's not yet used in the mining industry, but it's used in other applications. There's more and more power per pump, and that means as well. There's less pumps in total in such a hydraulic station, which gives you less possibility of breaking parts, or there's less individual things there. With the big pumps and with the big flow, there's another clear tendency. It was mentioned before. This is the use of a variable speed drive, and it is almost a necessity for controlling these big flows to have the pump controlled with a variable speed drive. So, in summary, the pumps become bigger and bigger, and they are today typically combined with at least one VSD per station. Automation, electrical control is getting more and more important as well with these hydraulic stations. That's for me for the moment.
Hello, my name is Kent Jones. I'm with Lion Power, and I am a registered professional electrical engineer and a senior member of IEEE. So I'm the electrical guy up here, and our task is very simple, is to get you the power that you need for these ever-growing systems without growing the size of our equipment. And there's a lot going on right now. If I think about going forward in the future, as Harry very astutely observed, we don't know where we are or where we're going, but what we have to do is be very good at what we do. So we need to be very careful to manage the things that we control. And it is the assessment of our group that there's at least three things that I think are worthy of our conversation today. One is that we have to increase our uptime. When we're supposed to be mining, we need to be mining. That includes bringing up the system more rapidly, and I'd love to talk to you about some of the things that we've seen there and the benefits of testing or pre-testing and doing compatibility tests with your vendors. The other thing that I think you really need to focus on is product life cycle. When times are lean, the equipment that you have needs to last longer and for as long as it was intended to operate. It makes maintenance very critical. I'm not saying you need to over-maintain, but you need to know what the maintenance schedules are for your equipment. There's a lot of things that we're doing right now to make our equipment modular, and again, that's an additional conversation that we can have. Just a simple example of that I'll give you in the context of something that we do is we have what we call a downtime saver. It's a 4160 volt motor starter that's very tiny and very modular that feeds up all the loads that they're talking about here today. It is modular, easy to service, and tiny. That's what we need. We need to be able to keep things small, easy to service, put different components on their own maintenance schedules, and just get lean and mean and green. And when you do have problems, you need to be able to address them very rapidly. So product lifecycle management is a big one. The third one is we talked about continuous improvement. And as a couple of my colleagues have already said, that's going to require even more and more commitment to the gathering and analysis of data. You cannot fix or you cannot improve what you cannot measure. How many times have you heard that adage? With the communications capabilities we have today, we need to ever be increasing the intelligence of our data gathering so that we can monitor and improve our systems. That's something that's very easy to do, very simple, very inexpensive, and absolutely necessary going forward to be able to do the continuous improvement it's going to take to stay competitive in a tough environment. So that's kind of three items that we internally feel like are very important to the industry going forward and to make sure that we have a good, sound future. So with that, I guess I'll toss it back to you, and we can talk about some specifics if the group wants to.
Thank you very much indeed. I think, can you hear me okay? Thank you very much indeed. I think quite a good introduction on the respective aspects from the panel. What I heard is more automation, more reliability, modular for maintenance, this kind of thing. In other words, keep going the way we've been going. We're not there yet. But I'd like to hear from the audience. I'm sure maybe there's some different points of view, or somebody can tell us what areas of weakness we think we should be focusing on or paying more attention to. Please don't embarrass us by not asking any questions or telling us we're talking a load of...
Don't be shy.
Whatever.
So I appreciate the introductory comments. I heard automation mentioned multiple times. It seems to me that one of the controlling issues with automation is what I'll call end-of-limit sensors or transducers. And I appreciate some comments from the panel on that, particularly as it relates to horizon control on shears.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, I guess. I'll handle it. Go ahead.
I guess the way I'd answer that is that's been an issue, or let me rephrase that, that it's been a concern that, you know, sensing has to be reliable if you want to achieve automation, and to some degree you want redundancy. And so you have to endeavor to do that, and it does, in some cases, adds to the envelope of the machine. There becomes situations where you're adding components on, maybe not integrated in as well as you'd like to make sure you're getting a particular position, and that's something that there's a lot of room for improvement on, I believe. Redundancy is a big thing that you endeavor to do, particularly with your communications, because if you're tending to run remotely, you've got to have your comms working 100% of the time. So I think most of the OEMs understand that, and they are working on dual and triple systems to make sure that's happening. I don't know if you want to add a comment, Keith.
Yeah, John, to your comment, I don't think we can eat the elephant in the room all in one bite. I think we're going to have to take steps along the way, much in the way Steve Bessinger in his presentation this morning alluded to. Let's take some of the technology that we've got available to ourselves right now, namely video, audio, vibratory, those kind of sensing, and try to create an environment for a shearer operator, for instance, in a remote venue to recreate what he's doing today as he's walking along with the machine. We can take those technologies, provide him with that capability now as we work on these more elaborate or more elegant solutions to the horizon control issue, such as background gamma radiation, infrared color sensing, those kind of things, to try to correlate where that band or where that marker band is. I even struggle within my own company at times convincing those that are responsible for allocating R&D funds that, look, we can't wait to try to develop all these elegant solutions. Let's take steps along the way to create interim solutions that will still allow us to achieve some of the safety benefits and the productivity benefits that can be gained as we get to that eventual end game.
Can I say one more thing to that? I don't think you want to underestimate the value of communications. Let me take, for example, the electrical system that we're so familiar with. If you have relays underground, then you have a tremendous amount of information. It is not – I told you that going forward, we have to work efficiently. It is not unusual now for us to work with our partners so that we monitor what's going on in the electrical distribution system so that you go to a problem knowing already what the problem is, ready to repair it and get going again, rather than to go and to discover what is wrong with the system. We have a lot of people that are watching what's going on in the electrical distribution system from above ground or from their office, or my goodness, we watch it with them. And that's one of the things that representing other vendors, going forward, you need to take advantage of the technical competencies of everybody that's involved with your work. I say that because you can view a power center, for example, and I'll talk in terms again of what I'm familiar with, as a part that you specify and you purchase and you integrate into your system, much like going to the Home Depot and buying a bag of nails and some lumber to build something, or they can be your partner. You really have to find people that you trust, and then give your partner the data. I mean, you got the communications. If something doesn't look right, let him look at the data with you in real time before something breaks and before you're down. Communications is just so valuable. That's the reason it's so important to find people like Lion Power and my peers here that know what they're doing so that we can help you do the diagnostic work because you can't be an expert on everything. And with technology and with communications, you can certainly leverage the expertise of your vendors.
Steve? Harry, a question for the panel. Maybe I'll stay. I got several questions, but I'll try to stay on the theme of automation and control. Do you see going forward, I'll see if I can politically correct phrase this, a hindrance in the U.S. of getting approval to do new things in the environment of the in the environment of MSHA and permissibility and the way it works, and internationally you can take a intrinsically safe device and it meets certain standards and you can use it in places, but here it's a whole different process. And I guess, do you see that as a bottleneck in going forward?
Start.
Great question, panel. Over to you guys.
We could talk a half hour on that.
Yeah. I've got just a limited experience on this, but certainly when you start talking automation, the Australian continent is embraced it to a higher level than the U.S. did, or before the U.S. did, and a lot of the work has been done over there, and there's some small successes that are being had over there. In the U.S., we have a few operators that are really moving ahead with automation, and we have run into an obstacle or two. It's kind of a work in progress is about all I can say right now to get some of these approvals through. I'll give you an example of that. You've got to pass through the face periodically to fire boss. I guess it's every 3 hours or... I'm not sure the details, but we would like that. You know, if you're running your face on automation, you'd like to be able to read those methanometers remotely, and that's something that's not been allowed. The rule today is a man has to go there and visibly see the methanometer. I could argue, well, why can't I put a camera on it and leave the same methanometer there? So that's an argument that's not yet fully been vetted, but just a small example of the kind of things where you can run into. I'd say it's not holding us back yet, but I can see a day when it will. Okay?
Yeah, I agree. Just to point to your example, for instance, we have a plow face working at Cliffs down at Pinnacle, and it's completely manless. The operator sits in the head gate entry. Because it's a plow system, you don't have ranging arms to control, so you don't have to have an operator there. Yet a guy has to fireboss that face every 2 hours for what? Why can't we use technology to fulfill the regulatory requirement in place instead of having a person actually do that? I think technology has evolved to a state that can allow that to happen. We just have to open our regulatory agencies' minds to accepting technology as a solution to that. As far as the approval, I don't know if it's staffing or I don't think it's anything more than resource availability that's holding that back. For an example, we really had a difficult time with personal proximity detection, getting that through the approval process, because the investigators were constantly being pulled away to do investigations on injury accidents, and their focus was no longer on the approval process. So it was kind of counterproductive. Here we're trying to get a piece of equipment approved that would enhance safety, and yet we couldn't get the attention it deserved to get the approval through the overall process. So I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think it's just an observation that we could probably do a better job and see what we can do to help in that regard. Certainly, I think a unification or acceptance of international standards would go a long way to streamline that process, at least a portion of it, as a way of streamlining the process overall and getting some of these technologies to market that really can pay dividends.
Ken? No?
Harry, this is just for the panel in general. It's kind of two parts. Obviously, as you stated, we have gone wider and longer over the past 20 years, not only for the productivity enhancements, but also to combat panel development. And we heard Chuck Shanak this morning talk about some outstanding productivity improvements on a 1,500-foot wide face, 17,000 feet long, but yet he still has 4 CM units running to support one longwall. So my first question would be, how big can we go? What are the thoughts of the panel about really, in this day and age, what are the practical limits on face width? And the second thing, kind of back to Keith's point, is we in the U.S. are really focused on shears, which are, in this day and age, pretty complicated animals, particularly when you start talking about gamma sensors, cameras. Any thoughts on looking at a plow installation for some of these faces to maintaining the comparable productivity levels?
You or me?
Any comments?
Here we go.
Okay. Jim, I'm biased in that regard, you know, as well as, you know, my buddy here, Ed, Nick Shears, and obviously our company has a plow in our portfolio. And I hold your sentiments exactly. It's an educational process. You know as well as I do, Europe utilized plows in their portfolio for a long time. Mainly the reason for that is that they were so deep, and skip haulage was their primary vehicle to get coal to the surface or get product to the surface. So every time you put a load into a skip bucket, if there was rock contained in it, not coal, you lost an opportunity for productivity. So obviously the European community embraced plows a little more. Here, we were always more shear oriented because it was more mechanized and also more consistent. In the old days, plows did not possess the kind of horsepower needed to be able to plow through some bands of rock that sometimes you incur. But technologies involved, drive technologies involved, evolved, and now that seems to be not behind us, but it's certainly been dissipated quite a bit. So, and again, there may be a day when we start going back after lower seams that are high quality and the demand for those lower seams come back. We're still mining the gravy, in my view. So we're taking the easy stuff now. Someday, perhaps, that'll change. When it does, then there'll be some technology like that available. As far as face width, I don't know where the limit's going to be. Obviously, you mentioned the wider the better, and really to cut down on your development is really the motivating factor for going wider. You don't make money when the longwall is sitting idle because it has no place to move. So your development really is the key to maintaining success. Right now, we're not stalled at 1,500 feet. We could probably go to 1,800 feet, and VFD technology is going to help us get there as well. So all of these technologies are going to play into going wider, and as far as longer is concerned, that's really a matter of ventilation. I think we can handle ventilation challenges that come along with those longer panels. I think we're going to see 24,000 feet. There's already places doing 22,000 feet. So where's the limit? I don't know where to tell you. Right now, it's probably in a neighborhood of 1,800 feet wide with, you know, 25,000 foot long. But that's only going to be temporary. We'll get over that, too.
If I can add to that, very good points, Jim. I think I have extensive experience in ploughing, as a lot of people know. And ploughs were invented mainly to tackle a problem with mining thin coal. I think if some of that same enthusiasm that was used to develop the plough for the thin coal seams would be applied to the thicker coal seams, then that may be a viable alternative to shearers. I think as far as panel size is concerned, I think the answer to that is keep going wider and longer until we reach the limits. I don't think anybody knows what the limits are. We used to know what the limits were. We used to know the limits of roof support capacities. We used to know the limits of face conveyors. But as new technologies come along with infinite start, load sharing, infinite build-up to starting procedures, that kind of thing, I think we... I think the technology is in place to try to go longer and try to go wider.
I would add to that. We had the privilege of electrifying the most recent, you know, literally award-winning productivity mine here in the States, and the electrification was quite easy. As far as growing the electrical systems, that's really no problem whatsoever. The next step is we went rapidly from 995 volt systems to 2400 to 4160, 12470. 25 kV distribution systems underground is completely conceivable and actually been done before. We've done, I think, a couple of systems now. Getting the power in place is really not an obstacle.
Yeah, I just want to make a few comments in addition to what we've already heard, which generally I agree with. One thing we have done in this country, I don't think for the wrong reasons, but we've chased our tail a bit on the configuration of the longwall face. You know, back in the days, say of a 34 millimeter chain pan and a relatively narrow, modest width face by today's standards, you know, it was pretty easy to mine 60 to 66 inches because of the height of your pan, the thickness of your shear. Roof support canopies were a little thinner in those days because we hadn't achieved the capacity in the legs that we are today. So, you know, it was pretty routine to do a 66-inch system, which is almost unheard of today. You know, just most customers are over 6 feet, generally speaking, because they need a heavy pan, because they need a large chain, because they have a wide face, and they also want long life to get through that panel. So for economic reasons, they found it necessary to have bigger equipment and more power, and they're mining a lot of stone that you wouldn't in the past, creating some wear, to be honest. So we got a much longer face, it's much more productive, but we also got a higher reject rate than we would have back in the day.
I totally agree with that, Ed. But consider this, too. I think a lot of that excess out-of-seam dilution is really created for ergonomic reasons by the operators who don't want to crawl or, you know, hunch down, run that shear 10, 12 times up and down the face in an enviable position, if you will. Yeah. So they end up taking more top than they really probably need just so they can comfortably traverse that face and control the shear, you know?
Yeah.
Part of it, not all of it.
Yeah, I agree. So that's one thing I want to mention. As Harry said, you know, every time we create a new plateau, we seem to be able to break through it. Face width is an example. You know, chains got up to 42, then 48, and now we're seeing 52, 56, 60 millimeter chains, finding ways to get them into the U.S. seams. You know, certainly they're appropriate for really, really large seams in China, Australia, someplace like that. But you know, the U.S. has always pushed the envelope in the lower medium seam area. We've always had the heaviest equipment, the most powerful equipment, and the most productivity. So that's going on as well. And then length. I'd like to make one comment on panel length as a shear manufacturer. Panel length is something we're not always consulted to the degree that we would like to be. A customer has a dream, and he's gonna put in a mine, and he's gonna have his super long panels, and we're just gonna mine them, and it has challenged us a few times to have equipment life that's commensurate with the length of the panel. So
just got to figure out a way to be able to change the shear out.
That is very pertinent to what we're talking about. We're trying to talk about, because it used to be the panel length was dictated by how soon the pan line would wear out.
Yeah.
So it couldn't be above a certain length, because if it was, you'd have to change your pan line mid face, and that was pretty much unheard of in my days gone by. So, when I say pertinent to the panel discussion, I mean, should we keep going in this direction? Bigger is better? Does it make sense? Maybe we should talk efficiency. I had efficiency mentioned. How do we measure efficiency? And do we measure it relative to cost? Do we measure it relative to what? I mean, what do we mean by efficiency? Question. Anybody?
I think cost is going to be your driver, Harry. Your market's going to drive what you can invest in, and as far as return on investment. So, if the market price is depressed on the product you're selling, obviously maybe we need to rethink our specs and go to a lower classification of product to lower our expenses. But I don't think we're there yet. I don't see that.
That's right. And we seem to be at another strategic change point in our long history of many strategic change points. I'd like to more general comments. You don't need to be a specialist in longwall. You know, we're looking for common sense, I suppose, as much as we longwall gurus that want bigger and better and wider and faster and more productive, and you know, and we could convince ourselves that they're more efficient if we get that. Does it make sense? Jin Chong, would you like to make any comments on the U.S. approach to longwall mining relative to China from an economic point of view? Can you give him a microphone?
You know, right now, there's almost the same philosophy, you know, the efficiency, the productivity, you know. And to me, when the lawnmower panel was 600 feet, you know, many years ago, we come to 1,000. Then, you know, right now, 15. So that's really the, also the geological condition dominated the tool, you know. When you have a wider panel, you have more support units. If several broken down, the entire start production. So that's right now, the China, I think that's almost the same. That's the same philosophy.
Yeah. Thank you. Steve, you had a question, you know, did you?
Harry, I was going to feed off of your discussion on length of panel and wear, because one of the other questions I had earlier that I was saving is, do you see in the future the ability to change components, modularization, change in materials, such that you don't necessarily have to wait to do everything at the long wall move like we do have done historically, that you do it when it needs to be done?
You pointed it, I think it's a partnership between the operator and the OEM to really work out the optimal solution as far as length, to make the equipment compatible with the mining conditions so that you're not out of sync, right?
Yeah, pretty much the same, especially AFCs, but to a lesser degree shears. There have been conversations. A shear chassis is pretty reliable and not really stressed to get through whatever length panel you throw at. The really technical part of a shearer are the ranging arms, and so it's really not a problem for the really high seams, because they, in some cases, they tend to be softer. In some cases, they tend to get enough tons over the projected lengths that it's really not a problem. But when you start talking the medium seams, say 2 meter seam, and if you were trying to go beyond say 20,000 tons, and you want a very powerful arm, and you want to really push it hard, you at some point you might have to have a conversation about swapping arms out halfway through the panel, which is, you know, not desirable, but it's possible, you know. So that could be become a common step, I suppose.
There's a couple of things that we brought up that I'd like to bring attention to. One of the benefits of economy or developing scale with electrical distribution, I don't think it was until we had large distribution centers that we started automating some of the text processes. If you've got to do ground fault tests and overload trips and the like, as most of you have probably seen, we're able to automate that. That's all PLC controlled, so we can take what would have been almost two full days of scheduled downtime to do required and routine trip tests can be done in maybe 45 minutes or an hour, because it's programmed. So there are definitely economies of scale. Now, when you start losing economies of scale, that's another discussion as far as follow-up on that. The other issue about modularity is at Lion Power we really emphasize that, and again by just to give you an example of something we worked with is again the downtime saver that I've talked to you about. We have had customers come to us and say, anything that can be pulled out, I want it to be pulled out. So we design power centers so that it's nothing more than a carcass with modular components, because you find that you'll have operators that have stuff in the distribution system that's buried in the middle of the car that won't even get serviced until you bring it out. Power factor correction capacitors is a good example. They tend to get buried, and you don't service them, and they're not absolutely necessary, so they don't get any attention. The other thing that a modular approach allows you to do is you can have different I told you one of the things I think you're going to have to be good at to be successful in the future is part of being lean is that continuous improvement, and you're going to have to maintain your equipment to make it last as long as possible. Unfortunately, as somebody already mentioned, not every component on that piece of gear has the same effective life. The frame itself may last virtually forever as long as you tend to it, but there'll be components in it that need to be either tested routinely or replaced more frequently. And the benefit of making modular designs is that you can put different parts of it on a different maintenance schedule, particularly if you're able to switch critical parts in and out. It's much, much faster to get in and out of the coal if you have modular designs. And it makes the system inherently smaller. It makes the system inherently more reliable. And I don't care if you're talking about a piece of electrical equipment or anything that's got controls in it.
Question about power roof support. Is power roof support pressures seem to have got to a point now where we seem to have plateaued. Do we think the pressures that we work at now are the optimum pressures for the systems? And do we think that maybe increasing pressures might be able to help us increase efficiencies? And maybe when we're talking about longer and longer coal faces, make the distribution systems more efficient.
I can comment, but you comment on the pump side, and then I'll talk about
that. Understand the question, Andreas. Did you understand the question?
Excuse me?
Did you understand the question?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. Verbally and mentally.
Okay, good.
All right.
No, I mean, just from a pumps manufacturer point of view, a typical, and I'm talking bar now, I'm really sorry for you guys, but typically we have today a pressure, long wall pressure of, say, 380 bar, which is, I think, like 5,000 PSI, roughly. We have seen in the last years that there's a certain tendency to increase the pressures, and I'm actually unaware if this is used in the US, but I know you probably know these high set systems which they use in Australia, and they go up to 410 bar typically. Just from a pump manufacturer point of view, we manufacture pumps which can produce 50,000 PSI pressure, which is probably never needed for a long wall, so it's no issue for us to provide the proper pump. Typically, with the pumps we are using today in four long wall operations, we can use them up to 500 bar. That's absolutely no problem and no question from a purely technical point of view of how high pressure our pumps are able to produce.
I understand it's technically possible to do the pumping application as far as generating the pressure. The dilemma or the challenge comes in the delivery, the hosing system. You're going to make the hose so stiff that it's not going to have any flexibility, so it's going to be difficult in terms of moving supports without fatiguing the wire braiding within the jacket. So the high-pressure set application is an answer to that. There's other solutions as well. You can have onboard intensifiers, if you will, that would be used to intensify the pressure from a set pressure of, say, 300 bar up to 450 bar. And without having the need for these delivery or increasing the size and strength of your main delivery system, but only those hoses that would be internal to the control system, which is much smaller diameter. But I'm an advocate. Higher setting pressures are a friend, for sure. In terms of roof control, without a doubt.
And of course, it's as well a question of cost. From my own experience, when the Australians used these high set systems, so it's actually a separate small small pumps and a separate hosing system. So we approached them and said, listen, we don't need this high set system. We can just run the pumps at the high set pressure, and you don't need to run two separate systems. And we have evaluated this, and unfortunately it turns out that the price increase for having the whole system set to this 410 bar was more than investing in a separate small system. So and clearly a higher pressure rating of the hosing increases the price significantly.
Go ahead.
Let me switch gears just a second and back up to a comment that was made earlier about communication. Data analytics obviously comes into play. Kent, you mentioned it early, and sharing information with OEMs, allowing them to help with diagnostics, that sort of stuff. That's one aspect and one avenue I want to explore a little bit. Plus, if you look at other industries or other markets, Australia in particular, there seems to be more industry collaboration amongst customers, you know, going after common outcomes, and ACARP is a good example of that, where the different mining houses get together and they're working toward a common goal of better efficiencies and better output, those types of things. You don't see that as much in the U.S., nor do you see the sharing of data as much in the U.S. Do you guys see that changing from a customer perspective? Is there a crack in that dam anywhere where you see that opening up at some point because of new regulatory pressures or because of changes in the market?
Good question.
I think it's just a logical conclusion. I think if an operator finds competent vendors and suppliers that are spending their effort to research and to develop product to address problems that we're aware of, then I think it's just to your own harm. Industry in the United States has gone, and it's not just mining industry, has always gone back and forth where is your supplier an adversary that you just want to beat up for the best price, or are they a partner that you're going to work together to be successful? And I'll tell you, it's vacillated. It's vacillated. But I think when times are tough and you're all realizing that if you're going to survive, you're going to have to be the most efficient that you can possibly be, then I think that is the perfect scenario to band together. I can't tell you how important we've talked about how important it is to find innovative and qualified suppliers that you feel like you can partner with and give data to. I just left one of our programmers, and he can view the data off of one of our large customers' mine real time anytime he wants to. If the guy has a glitch, if he sees something he doesn't like, if he has a trip, he can call up and say, did you just see this? Can you help me? Do you think you know what this came from? That's invaluable. And what does it cost the operator? Nothing. He's your partner. He's your vendor. I think if we don't do more of that, I think, you know, shame on us, because it is of mutual benefit, and that's what we all have to look at. At this point in time, it's about success coming together and working as an industry. It's not a time for adversarial relationships. I don't think so.
I think the question, though, was somewhat directed about collaboration among the customer operator base.
Oh, customers, yeah.
The Australian organizations pay a tax into a pool, and research is done using that 1.5 cents per ton or whatever it is that they pay in. And in America, it's quite different. Certain level of competition for the same markets between the companies. And it's probably a little less so in Australia, although that would be changing in today's today's market where everybody's fighting to sell their tons. When you could sell as much as you could mine, it behooved them to cooperate and lower their costs. But certainly it was advantageous for that market because they've moved the needle in certain areas as a result of the research that was done. And as we know, when I started years ago, we had a government research organization that was doing a lot more work than they're able to afford to do today. So the funding mechanism is there. You've lost a lot of your government funding. You've got an OEM base that certainly spends a lot on R&D, but would like to spend more. But you've got to have a return on that money. It would be good, but I just don't see it changing myself.
A cultural aspect here as well, in my opinion, and that is that the early days of Australian longwall mining focused quite a lot on what was happening in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom at that time was a nationalised industry, so there was virtually no competitive risk in sharing information, and the entire culture of the industry in the United Kingdom grew up around that kind of nucleus, and I think a lot of that was taken over to Australia. But I think, as Ed is saying, as the situation becomes more competitive and the Australian market evolves to that competitive edge, we may see less of that. Maybe, I don't know. I would like to think from a safety aspect that would be encouraged and increased. From an operational competitive point of view, I'm not so sure.
Good point.
I'd like, if possible, to come back to that nebulous word efficiency and back to what Jim said, Jim Breer, when Jim was talking about panel lengths and saying, well, development, to develop panels quick enough for the rate at which longwalls can extract the coal today, then the bigger, the longer, the better. Trying to tie that to this nebulous word efficiency. What are the parameters that dictate how long a panel should be and how wide it should be if it's not geological or not limited by the mine reserves? And anybody like to comment on that from an operational point of view? Jim, do you have anything to add to that?
Harry, obviously, I think from an operational perspective and also a safety perspective, the wider and longer the panels can be, I think the better off the operator is. Certainly, longwall operation in and of itself is safer than CM development. The less CM development you have, obviously more productive the entire operation is, along with enhancing the safety aspect of it from a pure mining standpoint. The fewer number of moves you have also contributes to the safety aspect. And as one of the panel mentioned, you don't make any money when that long wall's sitting idle or it's being moved. Now, that assumes there are no other limitations, and you mentioned one, and that is the size of the reserve. And I'll refer back to Chuck Shanek's presentation this morning, where he mentioned the installation of two slopes and two overland belts to minimize the impact of permitting and constructing new mine sites, new prep plant facilities, new refuse disposal facilities. So if that becomes a constraint, and as my colleague, Mr. Bouchon, already alluded to, I mean, the regulatory climate continues to get more and more challenging, then you have to look at something that Ed talked about. Maybe we need to take a step back and look at what is a more efficient operation to mine a cleaner product. So barring any other constraints, I think the operators are all in favor of wider and longer. But as additional constraints are added, then you have to look into other options to increase the overall efficiency to have the lowest cost per ton.
Good answer, thank you.
So I have a question for Kent. Kent, you mentioned about bringing systems up quickly, which I translate to be dealing with interfaces between various systems or subsystems. And assuming that's a correct presumption, my question is, are there, for example, any IEEE standards that the systems could be built to, or is there merit in considering such an approach?
No, there are not any IEEE standards. With regard to bringing systems up, you know, we were just discussing before we came up here. I think it may be sounding like I'm harping on the issue, but partnering with vendors and having vendors that'll go underground with you, having vendors that will do an extraordinary amount of pretest. Let me just give you an example. We put together entire systems, including the Komatsu pumps, on the factory floor to prove out as much as you absolutely can before you take this thing underground, where everything gets insanely more complicated to troubleshoot. So I do think the key is cooperation. I think the key to doing that is to do as much work as you can with your vendors. Make sure your vendors are willing to work with each other, and make sure they're with you when you pull the plug. One of our operator customers, I forgot what his slogan or what his goal was, but it was something to the effect, you know, into the coal the first pass. Well, that should be the goal. Make it work the first time, and that means dealing with a whole lot of reliability issues before you even try to run it, you know, on the panel underground with a live face. Anybody else have anything to say about that?
Yeah. We were even seeing a somewhat of a trend mechanically in the same regard. You know, before you would build your machines and you would have your factory testing where you would run gearboxes on no load and take a few temperatures, vibration, and good to go. And now we've got customers pushing us to do loaded tests. And for several hours at certain amounts of overload, because they're basically trying to make this thing start up and run as a proven, reliable system on day one or two, rather than go through this couple-week commissioning period where you're sorting out your difficulties, and hopefully none of them are big, but they all, you know, millions of dollars a day it costs you to be down. So you know, you could argue, as a vendor, you really don't want to do that load testing. You don't want to clog up your flow through your plant, but from a customer's perspective, it's the right thing to do.
I got a question. 2016, the new dust regs will come into effect. Between shield dust, sheer dust, where are we looking to go with that?
Let me answer that in terms of shield dust. Matt, we've incorporated pretty sophisticated dust spray systems into the shield circuits, as you probably already know. I think the key is probably now we've got the control systems capable of doing pretty much any kind of water spray application we want. I think the gentleman yesterday gave a paper yesterday about dust make and circulation. I think we probably can do a little bit more work in terms of research as far as identifying the optimal position of those sprays where they do the most good. Right now, we've put them on the shields with not a lot of research or rhyme and reason behind that. We could probably do a better job now that we have the control technology to precisely apply that water wherever and whenever we want. I think we need to now determine where are those strategic places where it's going to do the most good and not actually create a detriment in terms of creating a Venturi barrier or whatever that keeps dust in the wrong location, right? As far as sheer dust, I'll let you handle that, Ed.
I would say there's not much new happened in sheer dust in a number of years, in my view. I mean, the sheer clear system was designed 15, 20 years ago or longer, still in place today. I mean, there have been improvements made on bit holders with integrated sprays and sprays that are more reliable, which are big things, don't get me wrong. And sheer water systems have been opened up to reduce pressure drop through the machine so that you can maintain the pressure at your sprays. But beyond that, I think it cries for some further work, to be honest. And maybe a little more is possible. Maybe we're near, you know, maybe we're up on the asymptotic part of the curve. But once this fell out of the hands of the Bureau, other than some work a few operators done and some work that the vendors done to help them, there's not really been a very scientific approach in my view to improve sheer dust make. I think there is some possibility there, but I think the easy wins have already been gotten years ago, and the next bit of removal is going to be very difficult. You know, having said that, people just a common thing that an industry person will ask, well, why don't we put a scrubber on the shear? And believe me, we've tried many times, not physically. There has been one or two attempts physically, but if you start doing the math on the airflow that a dust scrubber can impact on a face compared to the airflow on the face, it's not a winning proposition. It doesn't appear. And then of course it has to be within the body of the shear. So what are you going to do with the trailing drum or the tailgate end drum? So we, while there's been some attempts at some hydraulic scrubbers on eventually spray arms on some shears in Australia, we don't really see that as being a workable solution. It could be in conjunction with some others, make a modest improvement, but it's certainly not going to solve the problem. So solving the problem, quite frankly, may have to be automation.
And I was just going to say that.
And getting the people off the face.
Get the people off the face, and that takes away the problem in and of itself. So we need to strive towards automation, remote control, because I, as Ed said, I think we've done pretty much all we can do as far as mitigating the generation of dust. So the key is get people out of harm's way and get them off the face so that they're not exposed in the first place.
Yeah. Including the fireballs.
Yeah.
Easier said than done, obviously.
Journey.
Anymore, don't miss your opportunities.
Gary's four questions.
You said you had a whole bunch of questions. Fire away.
We all need a straight man, you know?
You know, I think back of when we even did the first long panel at 20 Mile, and, you know, as a mine plan engineer, you know, I can draw a line on that map and that with that triangle as long as you want. So the question comes is back to kind of what Jim was talking about. How wide is too wide? I've often looked at a reserve and said, why the hell don't I just have a square long wall? You know, I mean, is 10,000 foot too wide? I mean, granted, I know we could get into all day talking about ventilation and ground control and all those things, but again, as you all alluded at the beginning, we've come a long way in 25, 30 years with solving a lot of problems. We could figure that out too, but just some thoughts. I mean, just wanted to throw that out there for fun. You know, how wide? What are some of the things you know? I think about moves, right? I mean, if I'm going to have a long well last for a whole reserve, it's got to, you know, be a new design.
I don't know, Gary, what are we looking at, 5-meter wide shields now, so we can, you know, cut down on the number of units we have to move? Then maybe we have to develop shield haulers and so forth that have low enough ground pressure to be able to pick up those rascals, right? So, as you say, you can't touch the chain without affecting downstream elements, and it's just going to evolve. I think as technology evolves in power distribution, power generation, endurance, strength in materials, and the whole nine yards, it's going to continue to grow because the answer is correct. There's not a wide enough panel. We need to go as wide as we can to minimize the amount of development and all the benefits that come along with it. Exposure to injury in the development process. So I don't think there's one answer.
I think there's an economic equation, though, on the number of roof support you're going to have to be able to afford, obviously. You know, and chain, you know, we alluded to chain size earlier. I mean, at a 20-mile height, you've got some room to play. You could get up to the biggest. You get 60-mil chain. I think you could fit in there without major compromises in your mining height. Right. So you're okay there. But a 60-mil chain is probably only going to take you, you know, maybe twice as long as, at best, twice as long as the widest faces today. Maybe not even that. Probably
not
even that. Yeah, but I think the economics of purchasing roof supports for that are really going to be the controlling factor.
That's beyond my capability to answer that one. I'm not an electrical guy. Maybe we'll let Ken enter that. Maglev, that's a unique one.
Well, do you think we've exhausted it, or we've got 20 minutes left if we need it?
We put him to sleep, Harry.
I think basically what was... Oh, okay, good, great.
Until we get to the full automation, guys off the face, where are we going with proximity? About some of your major injuries, shield the operators, getting in, setting a batch the wrong way or whatever, getting hit by a shield. Anything going on with proximity?
I think we both have the solution. If you walk over to the CB mining booth, you'll see we've got the offer. We've got our RFID tags for prox detection that's integrated with the control system. So that if they're, it's pretty unique. Tag identifiers will identify specific work classifications so that maintenance people would have a different reaction to movement of equipment versus visitors versus supervisory people. And we can identify, we can actually utilize it in terms of change behavior. You know as well as I do, Matt. People that run longwall faces, it becomes complacent, it's mundane, they're prone to taking risks, they've crossed moving shields 100 times before, and one time they'll slip and they'll get caught. So we're aimed at trying to prevent that, because even when we get to the remotely operated condition, you're still going to have maintenance people that have to go on the face, and you really don't want to halt operation, but you want to be able to protect those people. So we've got the solution there today. It's available.
Right. Much the same on our side. I mean, we're working through the details now. We're, you know, people have to register when they're going on the face, as Keith said, on your occupation, and buffer zones around their location to make sure they're safe within roughly a three shield window. The approvals, I guess,
we just got those a month ago. So it's been a journey. Let's put it that way.
But it is a undesirable benefit of automation that you've got to protect operators. Before, when you were manually moving shields, you probably weren't going to hurt yourself.
Right.
But when things are moving by themselves, proximity becomes necessary because
so many things could be done now with automation that sometimes it surprises people and that they don't expect, and they push a wrong button, for instance, and get an unintended reaction of equipment moving that they didn't expect, and they get caught. So it's no fault of their own. It just happens, and that technology will help them protect them from themselves. Right? Yeah. But it's available now. Long time coming. Mm.
Okay.
Any more questions? Any more comments?
I think what I've heard is that we've come a long, long way, but we've still got a long way to go. And I think on that note, I would like each of the panel members to make some closing remarks, and then if there are no more questions or comments, we'll wind it up. Can I start?
You're catching me cold, Terry.
Sorry. Let me start another with Kent.
I thought it was good. I thought, well, I was going to get to say that's all, folks. I told you that we kind of see three areas that it's going to take to be successful going forward in the future, increasing the uptime and product lifecycle management and continuous improvement. I guess the one thing that we really much didn't much have time to talk about here was product lifecycle management. I would very much encourage you that if you don't have schedules that you're satisfied with, that you review those. It's so important that you maintain your equipment, because when times are tight and you're not wanting, and your management's not wanting to spend time on equipment, then it becomes ever so much more important that you maintain what you've got. And I don't think that's going to happen unless you have proper schedules. Permit me to give an example, if you don't mind. Again, it's a product I'm familiar with. Take a dry-type distribution transformer in a power center. Suppose the thing's worth $50,000 new. And you kind of view that as one of the most passive components in the distribution system. You know, you can take those things before they fail. After they fail, you've got a failed transformer. It's time to buy a new one. And clean the thing up, steam clean it, re-varnish it, breathe new life into it. Why would you not make those kind of investments along the way? So my encouragement is to critically look at what you have and maintain it in such a way that you'll get the maximum life out of it. You have to be very efficient right now.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, final comment from the pump and the pump station manufacturer. I'll make it short. In the future, the pumps will be bigger. There will be less pumps in pump stations, bigger pumps. The pumps will be VSD driven, so there is more automation, more in general, more electrical equipment in the pump station, which is probably good news for the electrical guys. And last not least, I know somebody who has got all these wonderful high pressure big pumps already available today.
How about I can guess?
I guess my closing remarks would be I'm coming close to the end of my career. Probably the next time we're here might be my last. I'd sure like to see an automated long wall run before I hang it up. And I think the technology is there to support that. If we can just get some engagement from the mining community to accept a little bit of experimentation, if you will, without effect of lost production, but to certainly help us move the ball down the field to take these small steps we need to take to get to eventual end game, I think it'll benefit the industry entirely from the long run, not only from the operator's perspective, but also the miner's perspective as far as safety is concerned. And I can only hope that we'll get enough engagement from the mining community to see that happen, because I think Ed's company, all of our companies, want to see that happen as a matter of standard course. So it's mine.
Yep. Thank you, Keith.
Just from my point of view, one of the things that we take as our pillars of our philosophy in my organization is safety first, the productivity and lowest cost per ton. So we a lot of our decisions that we make on what to do, what to develop, how to approach a problem are related to those three tenets, and they're, you know, in that order. That's the way we want, like to approach things. A couple other things that I've penciled down here that I thought about that's kind of happened in the background that we really didn't touch on very well is how important monitoring is getting today. I can remember as a young engineer when somebody would call with a problem, almost inevitably you had to go to the mine and see it yourself to understand, because the information was just handed from person to person via phone. Sure. And but 90% of the time I got there, the problem with the machine wasn't exactly as it was portrayed, and
had the wrong parts.
So and it's amazing what monitoring is starting to do for the industry. I mean, we've got historical details of roof support pressure. So if you've got a top problem at one point, you can see, well, guess what? There's five shields in a row weren't properly
not
set.
Under pressure. Yeah.
Problems with the shear, you get temperatures, you get vibration data. So it's amazing. In a way, it's a bad thing because it's in some cases it causes our young engineers maybe not to see the operations doing what they need to be doing. They see it so remotely. So that's something we've got to work on a little bit. One last thing I think is something that we've been doing for a while is pushing the limits of the range. And you don't see this so much in America because our seam height range is fairly narrow here. Mm-hmm. But, we at Joy, we were busy in this mid-seam range for years, and then we've got into Australia and China and built some really big gear, mining up to over 7 meters, 23, 25 feet. Tremendous challenge there. Probably not going to see it in this country because we just don't have those seams, or not that we're mining an underground method. So that's quite interesting, and I think some of the young engineers involved will continue to push that ball ahead. It just probably won't be for this market. Low seams were something that everybody was interested in a few years ago. I'm not sure the market, the state of the industry warrants that today, but as Keith said, there'll become a day when that becomes more important again. So that's me. So.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Keith, I really hope you do see that automated longwall before you retire. Having been retired 16 months, I didn't. And would you believe, back in 1964, my very first job was longwall coordinator on the world's first remotely operated longwall phase. but thank you very much indeed for your input. Great audience, great input, fantastic questions, good points. And I guess, like I said, we've come a long way. We've still got a long way to go. And hopefully I can see a lot of that.
Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed.